Hello and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Garden Pod. My name is Amy Mush and today I'm joined by my colleague Etienne Bissard. Hi Etienne, how are you?
Hello, I'm really good and it's good to be here again.
Could you give us a quick introduction to yourself? I know you've done a few Garden Pods before. What's your role in the school?
Yep, so I am a jack of all trades. I am the deputy head of the primary school.
Yeah.
So I am responsible for curriculum review and development, as well as Key Stage 1 and EYC. So that's kind of where my responsibilities lie. I'm also one of the child protection officers.
Mm-hmm. And you've been at Garden for a long time, Etienne. You've done a few different roles here, varied roles. So you've got a lot of experience across all different age groups and different parts of education. But today we're talking about neuroscience, the brain, and how we learn.
Yes, it's quite exciting because this is quite a new field,
mm-hmm.
but I say relatively new in the last 10, 15 years maybe,
yeah.
that education is starting to pay attention to how the brain works when you learn. Neuroscience, brain development, and now that the technology exists to actually see what happens in the brain when we learn, I think it's a shame if we as teachers don't, it's almost like you have to have that as part of your training
yeah.
as a teacher if you want to really have an impact.
Yeah, and I think there's been a really big difference, certainly in the last maybe 10 years, in like teacher training providers. Lots of the things that we see coming out of the UK, the US, is a huge focus on cognitive science, how the brain works, how learning works. Teachers today will be very familiar with things like cognitive load theory,
yeah.
retrieval practice, the testing effect, all these terms which
mm-hmm.
when I trained weren't around. We just have Bloom's taxonomy basically.
Yes.
So there's been a really big shift in the importance of us understanding the brain and
yeah.
how learning happens.
Yeah, and I think for us at GIS, especially, I mean, we use Dylan William, we use his books and
yeah.
literature quite often, and he's one of the big names when it comes to people in education who see the value of understanding neuroscience. He's also a big champion for UBD,
mm-hmm.
and our curriculum is designed according to the UBD model.
Yeah. Just for those listening, what is UBD?
Oh, good. So UBD is understanding by design.
Yeah.
So, meaning the understanding that we want our students to walk away with need to be designed.
Mm-hmm.
And they also call it backwards by design, because
yeah.
you start with the end in mind. So for us, that would be A-levels or
mm-hmm.
year 13. And then you work backwards to see, so what will that then look like in nursery or pre-nursery, so that we can start at the beginning and make sure our students are equipped for what we want them to leave the school with.
Yeah.
So those we call the long-term transfer goals, right? So people usually get scared when they see in nursery, this is the transfer goal for maths.
Yeah.
But that just means it's a long-term transfer goal that we want our students to leave with, right?
Yeah.
So that's the understanding by design. Our curriculum's built on that. We went through a whole process as a school for a couple of years
mm-hmm.
to kind of map that and what that looks like. And I must admit, at that point, I was ahead of year.
Yeah.
And I didn't get it.
Yeah.
I did not
yeah,
understand
yeah.
it. I didn't see the purpose of it. And now that I'm more closely working with the curriculum, it just all slots into place and just makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And I think this recent, I read a fantastic book. I'm going to, the name will escape me now, but it's something to do with UBD and neuroscience, or neuroscience and UBD. Yes.
Yeah.
And they make perfect links with why we do those different parts of the UBD process. Things like, why are you building on prior knowledge?
Yeah.
What happens in the brain that will get students interested, or what's necessary in the environment for students to actually, in the first place, start learning about something.
Mm.
So that book, again, for me, just highlighted, yes, our curriculum model is definitely the right model.
Yeah.
We now just need to see how we harness this in our instruction and make sure that links, right? So that's why we talk about it today.
Yeah,
yeah.
Brilliant. That was quite a long introduction. But I think we've made some important points just around the need for it. Where would you like to start?
So I was thinking, do we start with the end in mind, or do we start at the beginning? So maybe, I mean, for me, this whole journey really started when I was in, started to get involved with the early years.
Yeah.
That was, I think, my third year on the leadership team. And getting down there and just seeing how learning is very different, but also realizing that you really start with a blank slate.
Mm.
And then that was the same time that Molly, that Australian girl, had the TED Talk, in which she highlighted the importance of the first 5 years of a child's life.
So early years for us is 2 to 5 years old.
Yep.
So little children, toddlers, kind of their first sort of engagement in a sort of school setting.
Correct. And I mean, that time is when Harvard also did a lot of research around what they call serve and return.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that model of you asking your child questions because you want to elicit certain things from them and you want to pique their interest and you repeat a lot of things and you mimic a lot of things. And that's all because that's when the connections in their brain happen at millions of connections in a second.
Yeah.
And also 90% of a child's brain develop, or an adult brain, if you look at the adult brain, 90% of that's developed by the age of 5. So, I mean, we have a huge responsibility as parents and educators to make sure that that foundation is strong.
Yeah.
And just understanding how to benefit or make the best of the time that we have to make sure that those structures are in place, I think it's quite important. If we start at the early years, I think if you just walk into EYC, you would understand that the environment is set up to do exactly that, right?
Yeah.
So from the moment this child walks into a classroom, their interest will be piqued somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that we know for learning. If you don't pay attention to something, you're not going to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So that attention is really important. How do you get a child's attention and hold it for that long?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at that age where they are easily distracted, you need to find their interests.
Yeah.
And you need to do that quite soon, quickly.
Yeah.
And I think the approach they have at EYC, which is planning in the moment, not planning weeks and weeks of planning ahead because you cannot anticipate where the students will take their learning, is so essential. And teachers, rather than planning ahead, they just in the moment with the students, no longer with iPads. In the past, the teacher would sit there with an iPad because everything had to be evidenced and, and tracked.
Yeah.
And luckily that has gone because that is really a distraction between really observing where the students are at, where the interests are, and where you take them next. So with the teacher just acting there and then on that, keeps that child's attention, it stretches, it builds on schemas as it forms in the brain. And as we know, that is really essential for learning to happen. And something teachers need to keep in mind all through school, right? Like what's already in a child's schema.
Uh-huh.
So which means what are we building on? And that's why that prior knowledge is always where we start when we introduce new content.
Yeah.
What do they already know? How can I make a link between that and what I want them to now learn? And then that's the brain just works much more effectively.
Yeah. And for non-teachers, this might not be obvious, but the whole crux of teaching is working out what you said there. What does this child know?
Yeah.
And then how can I build and develop on that? It's not about having a lesson plan and going in and teaching a fully formed lesson because you need to know beforehand what children know. Because all learning builds on prior learning. It links back to the schema you mentioned.
Yeah.
And also, if you teach somebody things they know already, then it doesn't benefit anybody. It wastes everyone's time. I also think another interesting point you made there about the early years is how much of a role the environment has to play. And you see that as you look up through a school, if you look at the environment for the youngest children compared to the environment for the oldest children, it's very different because learning for the oldest children in our school, 17, 18 years old, if you go into their classrooms often won't even have displays up. They have whiteboards that the students can use and work on because much more learning is about them, you know, working things out, drawing diagrams, working with peers, talking to other people, talking to their teacher, using a textbook. They don't have that same environmental kind of input into their learning because the priorities change and motivations change.
Environment becomes a distraction rather than a support. And I must say, I think in the primary school, they're getting better at not putting things up for the sake of having them up as wallpaper.
Yeah,
because
it's pretty.
Yeah, it's pretty, my class is colorful, but in the end, is it really supporting a student in their learning? Does it have a purpose? And if it doesn't, it shouldn't be there, because then it's just a distraction.
Yeah.
And I mean, I take it for myself, I get very easily distracted by anything around. And then if you try to learn and you're distracted, you will not learn, right?
Mm.
So yes, it's really important to focus on what a child already knows. That becomes complicated if you have 25 children in your class, all arriving with a different starting point.
Yes.
And that's why I think our school has become experts in personalizing that learning, and teachers really knowing where each child is at, so that they can individualize where they start with those children and differentiate. And differentiation is no longer, no, it never was, but I think at some point it became misunderstood.
Yeah.
It's not about giving the students who are struggling easier work and the students who are knowing how to do it harder work to stretch them.
Yeah.
Differentiation has become, where are my children at? What's their next step personally for them? But having the same expectations of all those students, high expectations, and then putting the scaffolds in place to get all of them there.
Yeah.
And I think our teachers really are becoming experts at that, which is, it's fantastic to see. And I think all this research and it kind of just backs the why behind things like no hands up and all the other things that we do in class to make sure that all students have an equal chance to access learning and to show what they know.
Yeah. So our early years, we're lots of use in the environment, using students' natural curiosity, the things that they're seeing in class, the things that they're interested in, that really motivates learning. Teachers are planning there in the moment. What does a child know? How do I move on to our next steps? That sounds wonderful. How do we then move on to our later years?
Yeah. That's really a good question, and also something I never given any thought until I went to UIC.
Yeah.
Something like phonics. Phase one phonics is listening to sounds in the environment, right?
Yeah.
Never in my life did I think that's where my reading or my knowledge of any sounds or letters came from. And it's such an essential step. And if you skip it, it might be problematic later. Similar to with writing. I mean, mark making is where it starts. And to be able to hold a pencil, you need fine motor skills. You have fine motor skills, you need gross motor skills first. Never thought of it.
Yeah.
I thought that just all happens.
Right?
And I think the fact that in the early years at UIC, they do know that, and they have things like a big mix that they start with in the nursery to get that gross motor skills. The kids are carrying those big tires around to build their playground in the morning, because that gross motor skill development is so important then for their fine motor skill development. And often, if a child in year two struggles to write, it's often because they didn't go to our UIC, might be a new child to join and skip some of those steps, which means they don't have the muscles in their fingers to hold the pencil, so it's painful, right? So we can't sit that child down and force them to write, because they become reluctant writers and do not like it in the future. But knowing that, oh, this child might have skipped that step, this is the intervention necessary to then address that, I think is so essential. And I mean, that links with brain development in a big sense, right?
I always think when we look at that kind of those foundational skills that need to be built before you can start your structured learning, it always strikes me that there are lots of things which have traditionally been done with children that even adults enjoy doing, which build up those skills that we're not aware of. And I mean things like playing I Spy.
Yes.
I don't know how global the game I Spy is, but I Spy, it's a game that you play with kids because kids enjoy it, but actually it's really helping develop their understanding of sound and phonics.
Yes.
And in the same way, if you are an adult who enjoys doing things like crosswords or word searches, or you know, you get those books while you're on a plane, all of those things are really, really, really helpful for children.
Yeah.
But it's not do a book of crosswords so that they're doing extra homework.
Yep.
It's just this is a fun thing which actually people can enjoy doing. It's a challenge, but it also helps develop skills. So there's lots of things that some families might be doing inadvertently which are very helpful for helping build those skills.
That sounds like a doctorate. Somebody who's actually do a doctorate in the origins of those games. Because
yes.
I always think the moment a group of children don't have technology, they immediately go get creative and they design their own games. Those games that they design are usually the games that we played when we were kids.
Yeah.
Without much prompting, they would come up with something similar to that, right?
Yeah.
And is it because naturally we are designed as human beings to learn and our bodies are designed to know what we need in order to learn effectively? So like those hand games that the kids play and then they sing a song or have a chant or a rhyme that they do it while they're doing it. It's coordination.
Yeah.
It's like there's so much that's important for supporting brain development, right? So
it's skills that help us. And the thing is, you know, the reason adults do crosswords is we like challenge. It just needs to be the right level for us.
Yeah.
And children are the same. They like challenge.
Yes.
They like, they have a lot of perseverance. They'll keep jumping until they can jump high enough to get on that box.
Definitely.
As long as it's the right challenge level.
Yes. And there's so much research around that links that to brain development. Because if you give a child something that's easy, the brain does not grow and nothing, right? No new connections are formed. For new connections to form, you need to have a challenge, right? And if the challenge is not there, the brain just stays the same.
Yeah, and it's boring.
And it's boring, right? You know, I read something that for me kind of made me pause for a minute and made me reflect on my place as an educator. And it's something, it was a simple line that just said, a child's brain does not physically look the same when they leave your class than when they walk into the class.
Yeah.
Right? That's huge to know that I have the power to kind of affect that child's brain development and what it's going to look like when that child leaves my class.
Mm.
And what a slap in the face would it be if they leave with the same brain that they came in, if it's as simple as whatever they learn in your class will physically change their brains forever. Right? It's quite a huge, a powerful concept to think about.
Yeah. We have a lot of power just in our positions, even in terms of what children remember us saying. And
definitely.
Or parents of primary children will all have the experience of being told they're wrong by their own children because Mr. So-and-so or Miss So-and-so has said that.
You have authority.
You absolutely do.
I use that often, especially with the younger ones. I think it's important that we define learning.
Yeah.
I did this in a parent workshop, and it was interesting to see how different people think about learning, and there were even different definitions of what learning is. I think in the field of education and at GIS, we would think learning is the acquisition of skills, knowledge, and understanding.
Yes.
Right, that we feel is necessary for that child to access whatever they need to access once they leave our school.
Yes.
And that's quite important. It's not a simple process.
Mm.
It's very complex. It's dynamic. And you can't always see it, right? Learning is invisible. There are, of course, indicators that learning is happening. And that's all we have to work with.
Yeah.
Because, and it's quite important if we think about inclusion in the classroom as well. How often do you hear teachers say, this child's not learning because they never sit still?
Mm.
Or they're always up and about and they never sit and listen. But there's no prerequisite for learning that is, I need to be sat at the desk with a pencil in my hand and my eyes on the board.
Yeah.
Attention, I need to be paying attention, but I can be walking around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is what you're thinking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have to say, tell this. I went to jungle school with the year ones or year twos. And one of the students picked up a worm, earthworm.
Yeah.
And for the whole time at jungle school, I was fascinated to show everybody this earthworm.
Yeah.
So at some point when he showed me, I'm like, so do you know that an earthworm, actually, if you were to accidentally cut it in half with a shovel, you'll have two earthworms because they actually have many hearts and both of them will survive, you know? But the child wasn't looking at me. He was just like playing the mud with this earthworm. And I just thought that is a fact that just went over his head.
Yeah.
And the same afternoon, we were leaving school and this child was with his parent. And I said, oh, you must ask so-and-so about jungle school. The child said, oh, yeah, we went to jungle school. I had this earthworm. And did you know that if you take this shovel and you cut it in half, then you have two earthworms because it had many hearts. And the parent were like, what? And I was like, what? You actually listen?
Yeah.
And that's such a good example of something like that.
Yeah.
every single fact I shared, he
was taking it. And of course, that's another difference between younger children and older children, is over time we develop the kind of social, most people develop the sort of social courtesy to look at people when they are speaking. But for young children, especially if you see young children playing with other young children, most of their interactions are not through conversations and they're not looking at each other. They might be playing side by side and talking and fully listening to each other, but they're not, they don't have that same social contract around kind of who they're looking at. And we can teach those skills and we can look at why children might, we might want them to do that. But when you come back to what is learning, I recently talked about effective professional development and how you measure that. And we talked about exactly as you said, the nuance around how do you measure, this was how do you measure teachers' learning, teachers' behaviour change, the impact of that behaviour change on a student, and then the impact on the student, which has obviously lots of facets. But it's hard just to work out how much a student knows. And that's why we have to triangulate so much information, student outcomes, and what we mean by that. Because it might not just be test results, it might be the difference between one group of students and another group of students for inclusion. Student test results, student outcomes, what the teacher's doing. We might go into lessons and look, we might look at work that's produced, we might look at results. So much information, it's very hard to measure learning.
Definitely. And, you know, I've noticed that a lot in the last year for me. Just because I've been thinking about assessment, I've been thinking about curriculum. I'm tutoring my niece online, which is a very, it's a total different experience as well. And because she is ADHD herself, I've realized the importance of giving students an opportunity to show what they know in their own way. Right, because her biggest obstacle is being given a test at school and she's expected to show what they want to see at that in that one way, when she has 10 other ways to show what she knows, but she's never given an opportunity to do that. And I think we're doing students such a disservice. And unfortunately, at this point, if they standardize tests and exams, there's one way. And I mean, hopefully with all the evidence now and all the research and all these areas, that might change into something just a bit more dynamic in the future. Because it will have an impact on a lot of students who are perceived as not knowing, when actually they do. Love it. Fascinating. So, I mean, another aspect of, you can't talk about neuroscience if you don't talk about the brain. So it's important to, this should be a subject for every teacher who ever wants to become a teacher. They need to actually dissect the brain and understand what that looks like. Not that I've done it, but I think I've done it in the reading. And how fascinating to know that there's part of your brain that's going to override everything in that system or in your brain, and that is the amygdala, right? So amygdala is your primitive brain. It's there to protect you against lions eating you in the wild. And it's also called the old brain, I believe. And that's the thing that goes into overdrive when a child is stressed, when a child doesn't feel safe. There's so many factors in school or from home that can cause a child to arrive at school in the morning in that state. And it overrides everything else. So which means no learning can happen. So usually in the prefrontal cortex is where your higher order thinking and all that new learning and acquisition happens. It's not where your reasoning. So that's why I see a lot of, on social media, people post things like, if your child's throwing a tantrum, that's not the time to have a conversation about consequences or trying to reason with them, because it's in overdrive because of all the blood is going up just in one part of the brain. And then what are ways to calm the child down so the blood flows back to the areas that need it, and then you can have that reason. And it's something as simple as, and I think that's why we start with things like the zones of regulation in the morning, so that the teacher immediately knows where children are at when they arrive in the classroom, right? That's the purpose of it.
Zones of regulation is about teaching children, it's the start of teaching children about recognizing their own emotions. So it's explaining to children the idea of you can be in these kind of four different zones, and zones of regulation is a particular organization and they do it by four colors.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can start with the younger children, quite basic language, and then make it more complex as they get older. But like red, the red zone is when they're very angry or they're not in a position to engage with learning. And
yes.
as you say, we can use that in a classroom for the teacher and the child to understand where they are and help them work on strategies to move them to a different zone.
Yeah. So ideally you want the child to be able to self-regulate. I mean, ideally you want adults to be able to self-regulate.
Yes.
Because we struggle with that as well.
Yeah.
Two neuroscientists that I've listened to podcasts a lot is Dr. Caroline Leaf.
Mm-hmm.
She's somebody that you definitely need to listen to. And the other one is Huberman. It's Jack Huberman. He's
okay.
a professor at Stanford University, a neuroscientist. And both of them would give strategies for adults. And it's something as simple as when you feel yourself in that state of overdrive,
mm-hmm.
even if you're in a situation where you are under huge stress because of something that's happening to you, and you know that you need to be kind of stay present so that you can act.
Yeah.
It's think three things that you smell. What do you smell? What do you see?
Yeah.
What do you hear?
Yeah.
And by doing that, you
yeah.
focus, the blood flows back to the prefrontal cortex and
yeah.
away from that amygdala, that kind of
yeah.
short, creating a shortcut or a short,
yeah.
short circuit.
And
in
that's
your brain.
A common advice for parents as well if your child's having a tantrum, with the argument being that you can't simultaneously be, say, trying to work out a maths equation and be having a very, very high level of emotional experience.
Mm.
So if this doesn't work with all children, I have three and I have firsthand experience, but
mm.
if your child is having a tantrum and you can get their attention and say, what's 3 times 5? Or depending on their age, find, can you see 3 green objects?
Mm.
It's the same thing. It's shifting focus away from one thing onto another so that you can calm down,
yeah.
so that you can then
yeah.
regulate and work out what happened and why you were in that state.
You know, like the example that Dr. Caroline Leaf gives, is she was in a situation where she was highly stressed.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't just say exactly what it was, but she's South African of background. So I can imagine something like a house robbery
right.
or something. And she knew that she needed to... So
yeah.
you can imagine the first thing you do is freeze or fight or flight, right? That's
yeah.
the kind of things that happen. And because she's a neuroscientist, she knew to take herself through a process of just, you need to know what to do here and not go into either of those states.
Mm.
And because of that, she survived that incident, she feels. So yeah, I think it's useful for everybody to
yeah.
have a strategy to just get yourself in that state. But back to learning.
Yes.
That is important for learning, right? You know, when we talk about, we talked about learning being invisible,
mm-hmm.
and then we said there are some indicators for learning.
Yeah.
Now, usually we would talk about those things traditionally quite abstract, right? You know learning happened because a child is able to recall something that they did and is able to transfer it into a different situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's all really abstract terms, but what actually happens in the brain when you learn? And understanding that, I think also, it's important to understand when you plan your lesson, when you interact with your kids at home, when you ask questions about what they did in school, because that can reinforce that learning, right?
Yeah.
And it can reignite interest and get them to, or it can also move things into your long-term memory because of the questions that you ask.
Yeah.
And I think a model that they talk about a lot is the video game model, which is about why do kids, you don't need to teach them how to play a video game. You can just give them the game and they will keep playing and teach themselves the rules
yeah.
and they will learn the rules as they play. So the video game model
yes.
is all about dopamine in your brain.
Yeah.
Now we know dopamine is released to reward you for doing something not always good,
mm-hmm.
but it gives you a sense of good
yeah.
feelings, happy
yeah.
feelings, happy thoughts. But how do we use that to our advantage? So I pass level one,
yeah.
I get rewarded by dopamine.
Yeah.
So I am then motivated to try level two.
But it's what we talked about earlier, and this is why video games work so well, is they're normally the right challenge level for engagement. Because if it's really easy, it's too boring.
Yeah.
And if it's really hard, you give up.
Great.
So it's the right challenge level.
Yeah.
And you also get feedback, right?
Yes, you get feedback because you know if I didn't pass level one,
yeah.
I didn't pass because I didn't jump over that barrel that came towards me. So next time I'm going to jump over the barrel.
Yeah.
The other really important point here is the fact that in a video game, there are unlimited tries, right? I don't only get one try, and now you failed, sorry, game over. I can try and I can try and I can try and I can try, unlimited.
Yeah.
So which means it's you're motivated because you know I can try as many times as I want. Now, what can we learn from that? We learn from that, if you think of your curriculum as a video game, where you start and you have checkpoints, the levels, and those small checkpoints are going to make students feel successful, reward them with dopamine, so that they then feel motivated to keep trying until they know what, and they need to know what the end goal is. And so they keep being rewarded so that they can feel that they're being successful and they want to try. They keep being challenged. They keep receiving feedback. And they don't only get one try to do something. And I think
seeing
that's,
progress is so powerful, right?
Yeah.
It's so powerful.
And they learn that, oh, I need to make a mistake to actually know what to do next.
Yeah.
In other words, I'm not going to learn. So I think for me, that's such a good analogy to build a lesson plan on.
And I wonder whether sometimes with some of the kind of more academic subjects, it might not be as easy for children to see progress in the same way. Because there's a swim gala going on right now for year six, which hopefully isn't too noisy in the background. But the nice thing about swimming is you can see very clearly the progress made from practice because you get faster.
Yes.
So you can be timed and you will get faster. And even if you're not making necessarily fast progress, you will make progress. Your own times, it took me 28 seconds to swim that, but in a week's time, if I keep practicing, I'll do it in 27.5 seconds. So you can see that progress. If you're doing maths or English or those sorts of things in class, because you tend to move on to harder, more difficult topics, you might find things challenging all the way and not necessarily be seeing the progress you're making and reflecting on how much you have learned.
Yes.
So getting that reward.
Yes, which is often just feedback from your teacher telling you, well done.
Yeah, absolutely.
That
you
did well. Did you know where you were previously? Look where you are now, right?
Yeah.
I see that in art lessons a lot, where the art teachers say, look at this now.
Yeah.
Go
look
back
how,
to your tube drawing that you
did.
And it's amazing to see the impact that that has on children. It's also worth mentioning poor proxies for learning, right? We said what are usually indicators for learning. Now, poor proxies for learning are the things that we use traditionally to look and think because we see that learning happened, which is not always true. So those are things like high test scores. High test scores doesn't mean learning happened. It might mean cram learning happened.
Yeah. Then we might just know that the child knew all that stuff already. They might have learned nothing in your classroom.
Exactly.
But, you know, their parents have already taught them that. And so actually, it might show you what somebody knows in that moment.
Yes.
Doesn't necessarily show you what they've learned in your classroom.
Yes, agree. Engagement. Engagement is, I guess, for me, the poorest proxy of learning. And how often do you sit in university classes where they say 10% of the grades are for engagement, right? And where engagement means nothing.
Yeah.
What matters is that student can leave that class and apply what you've said in that lesson so that they can learn by themselves, right?
Yeah.
That's much more powerful than anything that I say in a lesson. Them learning and acquiring skills. But routines and silent classrooms, and we know that like in the UK in grammar schools, you know, like that's how they advertise themselves as being effective and why kids are learning and having great. Whereas the research is, those things really is not the only indicator for learning.
Yeah.
Could be.
Yeah.
But it definitely isn't always.
Well, it goes back to your examples with thinking. A child sitting silently and looking at a board, they might be thinking really hard about something, and the silence around them might be enabling them to really think deeply about an idea and be very helpful for their learning. Or they might be thinking about what they had for dinner last night and not thinking about the subject content at all. The point is you can't tell by looking.
No.
You have to speak to the child, you have to ask them, or they have to do something, they have to write something down, they have to perform a piece.
Apply that into something.
You just can't see in people's heads.
There's value in thinking, there's value in time to reflect and think silently, right? But not that shouldn't be all throughout. And we all know that boys, for example, studies have been done that say that boys who are reluctant writers are usually because they didn't have an opportunity to talk about what they want to write about first. And they are much more effective if they have an opportunity to first tell a partner, talk to a friend, what are you going to write about, and then write. So I don't know why boys and girls are different in that study, but it's just like gender did make a difference apparently in that study.
Mm-hmm.
Right. A lot of content. The more content you give. I remember when I started teaching in Taiwan, I had a co-teacher who was Taiwanese, and she said, if you teach children this much,
yeah,
they will always remember half, right? So
yeah.
Now we teach them this much so
yeah.
that they can so
yeah,
teach them
yeah.
more so they can remember
yeah.
half of that.
Yeah.
And I mean, all this research is that is just nonsense.
Absolutely. No, there's no set percentage of how much you're going to remember from a lesson at all.
Yeah.
No matter those triangles you see about if I listen, I'll remember 10%. If I write it down, I'll remember whatever percent. If I teach
exactly.
someone else 90%, all of there, none of those
yeah.
mean anything.
And we also know the older you get, the harder it is to remember anything because of now your brain is just a little bit more, what is it?
Yeah.
Fixed. Yeah. So I think we've been talking for a long time, and I think we can probably go on for days. So I think maybe we can conclude
mm-hmm.
by sharing some top tips.
That would be good. Yeah.
Of what parents can do to support brain development at home.
Yeah.
Right. I think we've shared a lot for educators here to think about. And luckily in our school, this is something we talk about constantly as well. But there's so much to learn, and the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know.
Yeah.
So I think the first thing for parents is it comes back to that environment we talked about at EYC. So provide stimulating environments
yeah.
at home.
Yeah.
So your child's if it's their bedroom or it's a playroom or some part in the house that's just stimulating for
yeah.
them, right? The garden, things that's going to pique curiosity, things that are going to get them interested to ask questions.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how annoying questions get with
yeah.
kids, that serve and return that they talk about at Harvard University is so important, right?
Yeah.
If a child asks a question, then answer but throw it back with a question. Like,
yeah.
It's actually
yeah.
Google serve and return is actually. There's a couple of aspects to it,
yeah.
but really important for young children.
Yeah. I saw some really good advice once years ago for parents, which said, you know, often when kids ask a parent if they can do something, often together, the instinct for many parents is to say no, not because of what the child is asking, but because, quite honestly, the parent doesn't want the additional work. And by that I mean, you know, a kid says they want to do painting, and straight away as a parent you think, oh, it's going to make loads of mess, I've got to make the dinner, I've got to clear up that. And you say, oh, we haven't got time for painting, like, you know, do you want to read a book instead?
Mm-hmm.
And the advice that I saw is, whenever possible, say yes to your child.
Yeah.
And I know it's hard. Like
yeah.
I say, I have three children, I know. But wherever possible, say yes
yeah.
to your child. If they show an interest in something, okay, maybe you can't do painting right now, you're about to go to the supermarket,
yeah.
but can you put it in for another time? Wherever possible, if they're showing an interest, say yes, because that might be the start of a passion, which that child is going to go on to develop,
yes.
which will be important
yeah.
in their life. So say yes if you can,
yeah.
and just tell yourself, yeah, you are going to have to clear up that painting,
yeah.
but when your child's an adult, you won't have to be clearing up painting anymore.
Yeah, you're right. I've got a lot of friends with young children who's modeling that so well, and I'm
yeah.
always like in awe.
Yeah.
See, like, you know, when we were kids and you would interrupt an adult conversation,
yes,
and they were like,
yes.
oh, kids are seen and not heard,
absolutely,
you know?
Yeah.
Where a child would come and a parent would stop and say, sorry again, pay attention to their child. And I think that's such a beautiful sign to
yeah.
show your child that you are always the most important thing in my life.
Yeah.
Right? Not interrupt in a rude way.
Yeah.
Touch my hand or put your arm
yes,
in my eye until
yeah,
I
yeah.
know that you are here.
Yeah.
But you will always have,
yeah.
you're always the first thing. And yeah,
yeah.
I love it. Right, of course, invite curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that leads on to what
yeah.
you said, right? If a child's interested in something, let them explore
it. Yeah, do what you can to support that.
Yeah, so Jungle School for us is a huge one with that. So what's the Jungle School at home?
Yeah.
Of course, a nutritious diet,
yeah.
physical activity, and enough sleep is essential for
yes.
brain development. And I hear myself saying this because it's yes, especially with, for young children and
yeah.
the habits that we form with them,
yeah.
right? That's
yeah.
I know children who don't even look at, my niece is one of them. She doesn't even ask for sweets
yeah.
or candy because that she wasn't, it wasn't ever part of her diet.
Yeah.
And that's up to us as parents.
And sleep is something I've talked about a lot, and I continue to talk about a lot with parents, with students. And one thing that I always come back to when I talk to teenagers is, you don't need 8 hours sleep. You need the amount of sleep where you will naturally wake up without an alarm clock, without mum coming in.
Mm.
Your brain will wake up when it has had enough sleep.
Yeah.
So if you are needing, and I understand from a practical perspective, we all need this, but
yeah.
if you are needing an alarm clock to wake you up each morning, if you're dragging your child out of bed each morning,
yeah.
they aren't getting enough sleep.
Yeah.
And if you can't start, you can't change the time you leave your house in the morning, you have to change bedtime and make it earlier and get good routines in place.
Yeah.
And yes, it's frustrating if that means as a family you have to eat dinner earlier. Yes, it is. But can you maybe do that while your children are young and move it later as they get older and they need less or make other accommodations?
Yeah. Good point. Read together, that's something
yes.
we hammer on.
Absolutely. Read.
Yeah. It models a good habit,
yeah.
it models that love for reading, and we know how important that is in today's age where technology can easily overshadow that. And then I'll model positive reinforcement and a growth mindset, right? So for parents to model that if something's difficult, what they
yeah.
do in those situations, the language they use in those situations,
yes.
the self-talk,
yeah.
is so important, because we all know that children learn from the
yes.
environment
yeah.
and from what they see.
Don't say you can't do things.
Yes.
Don't say you can't do maths. Don't say that you can't run fast, whatever
yes.
it is.
Yeah.
Don't say that to a child.
Yeah.
Maybe instead, you know, if your child's really enjoying, instead of saying, you know, oh, great, I'm a terrible swimmer, why don't you say to your child, great, can you show me what you've learned in your swim lessons and help me get better
yes.
and model that kind of...
Yeah.
We all want to improve and grow all
Definitely.
The time.
And I know parents that go to drumming classes
yes.
and things that you would never...
Language
piano classes
lessons.
And language.
We have so many community learning series classes running every week. And
yeah.
we had a book club this morning with a librarian. We have French lessons, Bahasa lessons, and all these adult parents modelling lifelong learning to their children.
Yes.
It's brilliant. It's
powerful. Monitor stress levels, because like we said, if your amygdala is going to override everything else, then it's kind of impossible to learn. And I think that's top tips.
Yes. Thanks, Etienne. This has been a particularly long podcast, but I think we've covered some really important information and some useful pointers and things for people. It's a really big topic.
Yes, definitely.
How do people learn? And... the subject of thousands of books,
yes.
so it's hard to cover in 45 minutes.
And we've only scratched the surface.
We have.
Yeah, so yeah, I will continue to read, and maybe
yes.
next time we can record another one.
Great, thank you so much,
Etienne.